adapted to clothe the sharp man-made protuberances of the machine age with nature's smooth shells. The Studebaker coupes, pencil sharpeners, and locomotives of the era all hold the same ovular style. This was purposeful. Loewy thought the egg was nature's time-tested pinnacle of design and function, a structure of such precise curvature that a shell less than 1/100th of an inch thick could resist 20 pounds of applied pressure. Once you know Loewy's North Star, it's impossible to stop seeing eggs or eggish curves throughout his firm's designs. The breadth of Loewy's success raises a question. How did one man, or more realistically, one man's firm, develop a philosophy for what millions of Americans wanted in everything from toothpicks to space stations? Loewy himself offered two answers, one tactical and anthropological, the other grand and psychological. Loewy's personal style was effete. His suits and cars were each fussily self-designed, but his business philosophy was hard-nosed. He believed in ethnography as an entry point for design. First, understand how people behave, and second, build products that match their habits. When the meatpackers, Armour and Company, hired him to redo its 800 different products, Loewy sent employees on a 6-month talking tour to speak with hundreds of housewives about Armour meats. Their conclusion? The packaging came in way too many colors. To design Pennsylvania Railroad's locomotive, Loewy rode its trains for thousands of miles, talking to passengers and crew members to discover the machine's most subtle deficiencies. Although he is most celebrated for throwing a chromatic coat over the locomotive, his hours of travel also revealed acute design failures, like the absence of toilets for the crew. So he installed those too. Loewy was an excellent teacher of consumer preferences, in part because he was an obsessive student of consumer habits. He piggybacked off people's behavior rather than design products that would force them to change their lives. But Loewy felt that his sensitivity to the familiarities of his consumers connected to a deeper layer of psychology. His Maya theory, most advanced yet acceptable, spoke to the tension between people's interest in being surprised and feeling comforted. The consumer is influenced in his choice of styling by two opposing factors, A, attraction to the new, and B, resistance to the unfamiliar, he wrote. When resistance to the unfamiliar reaches the threshold of a shock zone and resistance to buying sets in, the design in question has reached its Maya stage. Most advanced yet acceptable. Loewy understood that attention doesn't just pull in one direction. Instead, it is a tug of war between the opposing forces of neophilia versus neophobia, the love of the new versus the preference for the old, people's need for stimulation versus their preference for what is understandable. A hit is new wine aged in old oak, or a stranger who somehow feels like a friend. A familiar surprise. The last chapter explained how one of the most powerful forces in popularity is the power of exposure. Exposure breeds familiarity, familiarity breeds fluency, and fluency often breeds liking. But there is such a thing as too much familiarity. It's everywhere, in fact. It's hearing a catchy song for the 10th time in a row, watching a movie that is oh so predictably uncreative, or hearing a talented speaker use over-familiar buzzword after buzzword. In fluency studies, the power of familiarity is discounted when people realize that the moderator is trying to browbeat them with the same stimulus again and again. This is one reason why so much advertising doesn't work. People have a built-in resistance to marketing that feels like it's trying to seduce them. Instead, the most special experiences and products involve a bit of surprise, unpredictability, and disfluency. Imagine entering a room full of strangers. You look around for someone you know, but you cannot find a single recognizable face. And then, suddenly, there is a parting in the room, and through the crowd you see her, your best friend. The warm feeling of relief and recognition bursts through the clouds of confusion. That is the ecstasy of sudden fluency, a moment of eureka. Pop culture is a parade of these eureka moments, large and small. Crossword puzzles designed for confusion followed by coherence. Aha! Great storytellers excel in creating tension followed by a cathartic release. Aha! In 2013, several researchers asked people to rate paintings by Cubist artists, a group that includes Pablo Picasso, Georges Braque, and Fernand Léger. First, the researchers recorded people's reactions to the paintings alone. They weren't very good. But then the scientists included clues to the painting's meaning or brief histories of the painters themselves. With these clues, audience ratings improved dramatically. Suddenly, the abstract paintings were not like the inscrutable backs of strangers, but rather like a new friend reaching out to take their hand. The creation of meaning itself is what's rewarding, researcher Claudia Muth told me. And artwork doesn't have to be easy to appeal to its audience. People like a challenge if they think they can solve it. She calls this moment where disfluency yields to fluency the aesthetic aha. Audiences appreciate aha moments so much that they also enjoy simply expecting them, even if the moment never comes. Somebody can enjoy a long book or television show that offers no answer for hours and hours if the genre itself promises a resolution. When the popular mystic television show Lost ended, many fans erupted in indignation that the showrunners failed to resolve the series' many puzzles. This deprived careful viewers of the final aha moment they thought they'd been promised. Some people surely felt like they'd wasted cumulative weeks, even months of their lives waiting for answers. But their final disappointment didn't retroactively change the sincere thrill they'd felt throughout the series. Lost was a monster hit for many years because audiences enjoyed the experience of anticipating answers, even though the writers were just stockpiling riddles without resolutions. Many people will put themselves through quite a bit of disfluent anguish if they expect fluent resolution at the end. Video games, too, are often puzzles whose interactivity offers the wondrous click of recognition or jolt of accomplishment. The most popular video game of all time is Tetris. Alexei Pochitnov was a 28-year-old computer scientist working at a Soviet R&D center in Moscow when, after buying a set of funny-shaped dominoes, he got an idea for a video game. On June 6, 1984, he released an early version which he named by combining Tetra, after the four square blocks of each game piece, with tennis, his favorite sport. Before long, the game spread across Moscow, hopped over to Hungary, was nearly stolen by a British developer, and went on to become the best-selling video game of all time, selling 400 million copies. The game is a dance of anticipation and completion. Many novels and mystery stories may be analogous to falling puzzle pieces clicking into place, but Tetris is explicitly just that. The second best-selling game of all time is Minecraft, where users build shapes and virtual worlds from digital bricks. Minecraft is a kind of cultural inheritor to Lego, which was itself an heir to the heritage of playing with blocks, as tech journalist Clive Thompson wrote. But whereas Lego sets often come with a detailed set of precise instructions, Minecraft is more open-ended. The most popular games for smartphones, where the level of play must be simple enough to execute with a stray thumb, are often puzzles too, including 2048 and Candy Crush. The point of these games is neither to make players tear out their hair, nor to give away the secret too easily, but rather to design what the neurologist Judy Willis calls an achievable challenge. Most advanced, yet achievable. Maya. Smaller aha moments, the sort that make you simply smile rather than sprint naked through the neighborhood, are all around us. There's a popular online video called Four Chords with more than 30 million views in which the musical comedy group, The Axis of Awesome, cycles through dozens of songs built on the same four chords. 1-5-6-4. This chord progression is the backbone of dozens of classics, including oldie hits, The Beatles' Let It Be, karaoke pop, Journey's Don't Stop Believin', country sing-along, John Denver's Take Me Home, Country Roads, arena rock, U2's With or Without You, animated musical, The Lion King's Can You Feel the Love Tonight, acoustic pop, Jason Mraz's I'm Yours, reggae, Bob Marley's No Woman, No Cry, and modern dance pop, Lady Gaga's Paparazzi. In 2012, Spanish researchers released a study that looked at 464,411 popular recordings around the world between 1955 and 2010 and found the difference between new hits and old hits wasn't more complicated chord structures. Instead, it was new instrumentation bringing a fresh sound to common harmonic progressions. Several music critics use videos like Four Chords to argue that pop music is simply derivative. But this seems backward. First, if the purpose of music is to move people, and people are moved by that which is sneakily familiar, then creative people should aspire for a blend of originality and derivation. Second, it's simply wrong to say that all 1-5-6-4 songs sound the same. Don't Stop Believin' and No Woman, No Cry and Paparazzi don't sound anything alike. These songwriters aren't retracing each other's steps. They're more like clever cartographers, each given an enormous map, plotting new routes home. The aha effect isn't bound to arts and culture. It's a powerful force in the academic world as well. Scientists and philosophers are exquisitely sensitive to the advantage of ideas that already enjoy broad familiarity. The history of science is a long story about good ideas facing rejection after punishing rejection until enough scientists become acquainted with the concepts, at which point they become law. Max Planck, the theoretical physicist who helped lay the groundwork for quantum theory, said, "A new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die and a new generation grows up that is familiar with it." In 2014, a team of researchers from Harvard University and Northeastern University wanted to know exactly what sort of proposals were most likely to win funding from prestigious institutions, like the National Institutes of Health. Safely familiar proposals or extremely creative ones? They prepared about 150 research proposals and gave each one a novelty score. Then they recruited 142 world-class scientists to evaluate each project. The most novel proposals got the worst ratings. "Everyone dislikes novelty," lead author Karim Lakhani explained to me. "And experts tend to be overcritical of proposals in their own domain." Extremely familiar proposals fared a little bit better, but they also received lower scores. The highest evaluation scores went to submissions that were deemed slightly new. There is an optimal newness for ideas, Lakhani said. Advanced, yet acceptable. This appetite for optimal newness runs throughout the hitmaking world. Film producers like NIH scientists have to evaluate hundreds of projects a year, but can accept only a tiny percentage. To grab their attention, writers often frame original ideas as a fresh combination of two familiar successes using a high-concept pitch, like "It's Romeo and Juliet on a sinking ship," Titanic, or "It's Toy Story with talking animals," The Secret Life of Pets. In Silicon Valley, where venture capitalists also sift through a surfeit of proposals, high-concept pitches are so common that they're practically a joke. The home rental company Airbnb was once called eBay for homes. The on-demand car service companies Uber and Lyft were once considered Airbnb for cars. When Uber took off, new startups took to branding themselves Uber for anything. Creative people often bristle at the suggestion that they have to stoop to market their ideas or dress them in familiar garb. It's pleasant to think that an idea's brilliance is self-evident and doesn't require the theater of marketing. But whether you're an academic, screenwriter, or entrepreneur, the difference between a brilliant new idea with bad marketing and a mediocre idea with excellent marketing can be the difference between bankruptcy and success. The trick is learning to frame your new ideas as tweaks of old ideas, to mix a little fluency with a little disfluency, to make your audience see the familiarity behind the surprise. For the last decade and more, the most valuable brand in media has been ESPN. For many years, the sports network has accounted for half of the Walt Disney Company's annual profit and more than its entire movie division. Much of ESPN's lucre comes from the quirky economics of sports and the modern television business. The traditional TV audience, the one with a remote control, a cable box, and a live menu of shows, has taken a gut punch in the last decade. Between 2010 and 2015, the amount of time 18 to 34-year-olds spent watching traditional cable TV declined by about 30%. To get people to sit down in front of a live show and be present for the live advertising, executives have doubled down on entertainment that must be seen now. That includes live musicals, live variety shows, live game shows, live singing shows, and, most important, live sports. Sports are the keystone of the cable TV arch. Without them, the whole thing collapses. Every month, your cable company sends about one half of your cable bill straight to the TV networks you can see on the menu. These fees range from a penny to a few dollars. ESPN gets about $6 or $7 per paid TV customer per month, whether that household watches 0 minutes of ESPN or 100 hours. This is the equivalent of tens of millions of households buying 6 movie tickets a year to the same film, even if they don't watch any of the movie. But the network's financial ascent in the last decade was more than a clever bank shot off the economics of TV bundling. It also has to do with engineering familiarity. At the network's New York City headquarters on West 66th Street in 2014, I sat with Artie Bulgren, ESPN's director of research, in a wood-paneled conference room as he swooshed through slides of a massive annual presentation that he'd prepared for the company since 1998. He stopped at what he called the money chart. It showed the results of a survey asking men for their favorite cable networks. Men have named us their favorite channel for 14 straight years, he said. Other networks need to create hits. We don't. People tune in to ESPN without even knowing what's on. the worldwide leader in sports didn't always enjoy such dominance. At the turn of the century, the network was in crisis. In the late 1990s, ESPN found itself languishing after a decade of out-of-control growth. As we grew, we tried to be everything to everyone, ESPN sales and marketing VP Sean Bratches said, sitting to Balgren's right in the 66th Street conference room. We had bass fishing and cheerleading and salsa dancing and scripted dramas and comedy shows, he said. We tried to promote every single thing rather than focus on a few things. To guide the turnaround, ESPN tapped an unlikely new leader. John Skipper, a magazine editor with no experience in television, arrived at Disney after serving as president of the music magazine Spin. In his 15 years at ESPN before becoming president in 2012, he oversaw Disney-branded magazines and books, launched ESPN the magazine, and managed the website ESPN.com. ESPN had lost a sense of its core, Skipper told the company's leaders at one of the first executive meetings. Rather than being great at serving one perfect product, like a steakhouse, it had become a network that served lots of mediocre fare, like a cheap diner. Skipper started the turnaround by focusing on SportsCenter, ESPN's unavoidable collage of the day's news. Rather than serve many audiences across the sports spectrum, from college squash to Indian cricket, he said SportsCenter should spend more hours covering mostly the most popular storylines. Why? To maximize the odds that whenever a fan tuned in, he could expect to see a team, player, or controversy that he recognized, like the New England Patriots, LeBron James, or Olympic doping scandals. SportsCenter would become, he decided, an entertainment steakhouse, serving up new takes on the same core sports, stars, and scandals over and over and over. After that, Balgren said, things started to change rather dramatically. SportsCenter had become the thing every sports fan quietly craves, a news machine for delivering new takes on familiar stories. Ratings soared, and ESPN has been the favorite network of American men every year since. In the last few years, CNN has taken the same approach, devoting more time to fewer stories like terrorist attacks and disappearing airplanes. This makes for pretty repetitive TV if you watch all day long. But who would want to watch CNN all day long? The typical television news viewer watches about 5 minutes of cable TV news per day. CNN is doing something smart, maximizing viewers' expectations that they will see a story they recognize no matter when they tune in. Throughout the 2016 election, the CNN spotlight trained its white-hot focus on Donald Trump, who reportedly referred to network president Jeff Zucker as his personal booker. Media critics sighed over CNN's singular obsession, but the strategy paid off, at least in the most literal sense. In 2015, CNN saw its highest viewership in 7 years and enjoyed the strongest rate of advertising growth of any cable news network. Journalists mocked the network's Trumpist worship, often with good reason. But television economics is not a morality play. Trump and Zucker's relationship proved to be fantastically profitable. ESPN and CNN have discovered what Top 40 radio has known for several decades. Most people tune in to a broadcast to hear more of something they already know. Radio audiences can't anticipate what the next song will be. But as every car driver and radio executive will affirm, people mostly just want to hear songs they recognize. For decades, DJs on pop music radio stations have considered unfamiliar songs to be tune-outs, because audiences tend to spurn new music. These listeners want to be surprised. That's why they play the radio rather than a CD or playlist. But they want to be surprised by the feeling of familiarity. The age of old-school television with one dominant screen and one live stream is giving way to an age of social video networks with billions of screens and zillions of personalized feeds. From 2010 to 2015, the average viewership of SportsCenter fell by almost 40% among 18 to 34-year-olds. The most valuable piece of glass for ESPN today might be the smartphone screen. In an average week, ESPN delivers more than 700 million alerts to tens of millions of phones. When something big happens in sports, more than 7 million people get a notification from ESPN in their pockets and purses. That's more than 10 times the typical SportsCenter audience. 1.5 million people, a sizable audience for a TV show, have signed up for news alerts for a single basketball team, the Golden State Warriors. When the Bay Area squad does something newsworthy, ESPN buzzes on the home screen of more people than the combined city populations of San Francisco and Oakland. Technology is quickly changing the delivery of news, but not necessarily the philosophy of what people want from it. Consider a news ecosystem quite opposite from ESPN and cable news, Reddit, a community news site created entirely by anonymous users. On Reddit, each piece of content is two parts, a headline and an article link. Users can promote links with upvotes or register their dissatisfaction with downvotes. Several years ago, a team of computer science researchers at Stanford University submitted and resubmitted thousands of images to Reddit with different headlines and controlled for network effects to see if the Reddit community had a clear preference for certain titles. They wanted to understand a question that I think about all the time. What makes a great headline? In my time at The Atlantic, I've developed, refined, discarded, and revived countless pet theories about what makes a perfect headline. When I was younger, I used to say a great headline should be definitive or delightful. That is, it should try to make a clear and superlative statement. One graph explains why the United States is the world's best place to start a company. Or it should be obviously funny or cute. I can't stop looking at this baby tiger play with yarn. Several years ago, the internet was awash with an exotic species of headline based on something called the curiosity gap. That is, the writer tells the reader enough to pique interest, and then, like a cheap magician, says, "You won't believe what happens next." These headlines conquered the world, well, my world, for several months, then fell out of fashion for the same reason that people tire of every marketing gimmick. When you're savvy to the source of fluency, you tend to discount the stimulus as boring or manipulative. When the audience knows the formula, a magic trick isn't magic anymore. It's just a trick. After the curiosity gap year, however, The Atlantic continued to find great success with stories about the mind and body, essentially psychology and health. And my personal headline motto changed again to, "A reader's favorite subject is the reader." Meanwhile, these Stanford computer scientists were putting empirical meat on the bare bones of my headline writing theories. They concluded that the most successful headlines on Reddit presented novel images or stories, while conforming to the linguistic norms of the community to which it is submitted. A good headline, they said, is not overly familiar, but rather familiar enough. A welcome surprise expressed in the vernacular of its intended audience. A promise to advance understanding in a broadly acceptable subject. Maya. If a television is a piece of furniture, a mobile device is an appendage, not just familiar, but personal and even intimate. A one-screen world targets the mainstream. But now people get music, news, and everything else from the piece of glass in their pockets. This billion-screen world, not bounded by the limits of linear programming, is tailored to individuals. And although everybody has an appetite for the familiar, appetites can vary. With more than 81 million listeners and 21 billion hours of played music each year, Pandora is the most popular digital radio app in the world. Name the bands you like, and Pandora builds a radio station around their sound. If I say I like the Beatles, Pandora will play the Kinks, the Rolling Stones, and newer bands with a Beatles-y vibe. Users can make the station better by signaling the songs they love or by skipping the songs they don't. These interactions give Pandora scientists a bird's-eye view of how tastes work. Pandora's algorithm isn't best thought of as one formula. It's more like an orchestra of dozens and dozens of formulas that are conducted by a meta-formula. One of the most important instruments in this algorithmic symphony is familiarity. The most common complaint about Pandora is that there is too much repetition of bands and songs, said Eric Bischke, the first chief data scientist at Pandora. Preferences for familiarity are much more individual than I would have thought. You can play the exact same songs to two people with the same tastes in music. One will consider the station perfectly familiar, and the other will consider it horribly repetitive. There are two fascinating implications here. The first is that neophobia, or preference for the familiar, is not a universal human constant. Rather, there is a spectrum between people who like things that are extremely familiar and people who like things that surprise. A Beatles fan who wants to hear only the Beatles versus a Beatles fan who wants to hear only new songs with John Lennon inflections. A family that likes going to the same place for each vacation versus a family that never goes on the same vacation twice. The most significant neophilic group in the consumer economy is probably teenagers. Young people are far more receptive to advanced designs, Lowy wrote, because they have the smallest stake in the status quo. The dream of the alert industrial designer would be to design for teenagers. Whether or not they fall periodically for some silly fad that does harm to no one, their basic taste remains fundamentally correct. The second implication of Pandora's analysis is that familiarity as a taste can vary by genre. Some people are music hipsters. They love hopping between esoteric bands. But information moles. They read only one local liberal blog. Others are the opposite. Musically conservative, but adventurous about reading political columns by writers they disagree with. As Lowy understood, neophilia and neophobia are not isolated states, but rather warring states, constantly doing battle both within the mind of every buyer and within an entire economy of buyers. I recently visited Spotify, the large online streaming music company, to talk to Matt Ogle, the lead engineer on a new hit product called Discover Weekly, a personalized list of 30 songs delivered every Monday to tens of millions of users. For about a decade, Ogle had worked for several music companies to design the perfect music recommendation engine. His philosophy of music was that most people enjoy new songs, but they don't enjoy the effort that it takes to find them. They want effortless, frictionless musical revelations, a series of achievable challenges. In the design of Discover Weekly, every decision we made was shaped by the notion that this should feel like a friend giving you a mixtape, he said. So the playlist was weekly and included only 30 songs. Here's how it works. Each week, Spotify bots hunt through several billion playlists from users around the world to see what songs are typically grouped together. Imagine that song A, song B, and song C often appear together in the same playlist. If I often listen to songs A and C, Spotify guesses that I'll probably like song B, even if I've never heard of its band. This way of predicting tastes by aggregating millions of people's preferences is known as collaborative filtering. Collaborative because it takes many users' inputs, and filtering because it uses the data to narrow down the next thing you want to hear. It's conceptually similar to the algorithms that power the related items sections of Amazon and other shopping sites. If many people purchase a certain chair with a certain table, buyers of that table will be prompted to buy the chair. At the end of our interview, Ogle and I talked about how most music fans, but not all, are fundamentally conservative. They like what they like, and they don't want to be too challenged by music. The line from psychologists is, "If you've seen it before, it hasn't killed you yet," I joked. Ogle's face lit up. "I have a story for you," he said. The original version of Discover Weekly was supposed to include only songs that users had never heard before. But in its first internal test at Spotify, a bug in the algorithm let through songs that users already knew. Everyone reported it as a bug, and we fixed it so that every single song was totally new, he said. But after his team fixed the bug, something unusual happened. Engagement with the playlist fell. It turns out having a bit of familiarity bred trust, especially for first-time users. If we make a new playlist for you and there's not a single thing for you to hook onto or recognize, to go, "Oh yeah, that's a good call," it's completely intimidating and people don't engage. The original bug was actually an essential feature. Discover Weekly was a more appealing product when it had even one familiar band or song. I think users wanted to trust the feature, but they were waiting to see some sign that it knew them too, Ogle said. Spotify users wanted a fresh taste, but they also wanted to make sure it wouldn't kill them. By the 1950s, Raymond Loewy could reasonably claim that the most iconic car, the most used locomotive, and the most famous airplane in mid-century America all sprung from the sharpened tip of a Loewy pencil. So what can he teach today's artists about how to make a hit? Maya offers three clear lessons. First, audiences don't know everything, but they know more than creators do. The most successful artists and entrepreneurs tend to be geniuses. But the paradox is that they are both smarter than their median consumer and dumber than all of their consumers because they don't know how their consumers live, what they do every day, what annoys them, or what moves them. If familiarity is the key to liking, then people's familiarities, the ideas, stories, behaviors, and habits with which they are fluent, are the keys to their heart. Loewy had his own theories of beauty, his eggshells and his chrome finishes, but he knew that designing for strangers was, at the beginning, like fumbling through a dark tunnel toward a tiny speck of light. He was obsessed with understanding the people he was designing for. Second, to sell something familiar, make it surprising. To sell something surprising, make it familiar. At the far reaches of radical thinking, it's critical for artists and entrepreneurs with wild ideas to heed the pull of familiarity and remember Max Planck's warning. Even the most brilliant scientific breakthroughs face initial skepticism when they are too far from mainstream thought. Great art and products meet audiences where they are. But the fact that people gravitate to fluency in art and design is no excuse for dumb simplicity. The central insight of Maya is that people actually prefer complexity up to the point that they stop understanding something. Many of today's museum goers don't just stare at the water lilies. They enjoy strange and abstract art that gives them a feeling or a jolt of meaning. TV viewers don't just watch reruns. They like complex mysteries with narrative puzzles that come to completion. Theater goers love familiar revivals, but the most influential Broadway smash hits are ones like Hamilton that tell a familiar story in an ingeniously new way. The power of fluency, after all, is strongest when it emerges from its opposite, a challenging period of disfluency, to create an aha moment. Third, people sometimes don't know what they want until they already love it. Loewy and his ilk were constantly pushing tastes forward among an audience of mid-century Americans who didn't know they wanted anything new. In the final pages of his memoir, Loewy relays an old joke about a Boy Scout and his Scoutmaster discussing the day's mandatory good deed. "And what good have you done today, Ray?" "Walter Henry and I helped a lady across the street," the boy says. "Very nice. But why did it take three of you?" "The old lady did not want to cross." If Loewy had been a Boy Scout, he would have been like his namesake, Ray. Pushy, while playing within certain rules. He had taught drowsy, machine-age consumers to be neophiles of the highest order. He nourished an appetite for surprise to go with their taste for the familiar. The young man who surveyed New York City in 1919 from the top of the Equitable Building at 120 Broadway saw the other side of a street and carried the country across. He did not ask for permission. Chapter 3. The Music of Sound. The Power of Repetition in Song and Speech. Savan Kotecha knows the number by heart. 160. It is the number of rejection letters he keeps in a folder at his parents' home in Austin, Texas. The signatures include the names of some of the most famous labels and music publishers in the country. Each one came to the same conclusion. Kotecha's songs just weren't good enough. Today, Kotecha's reputation hangs on larger numbers. 200 million, for example, is the number of copies of Kotecha's songs that have sold worldwide. As a writer and producer for pop stars like Ariana Grande, Justin Bieber, Usher, Maroon 5, Carrie Underwood, and One Direction, Kotecha has become one of the most prolific young pop music writers in the United States, and a contributor on more than a dozen top 10 songs in the US and UK, including several number one hits like Can't Feel My Face by The Weeknd and What Makes You Beautiful by One Direction. When he was a boy, Kotecha's father worked for IBM, which moved the family all over the country. In Austin, where they finally landed, he slept in the living room couch of his parents' small apartment. One day, he wandered into his sister's room and discovered a keyboard. He sat down to play with it. Something lit up inside him. From that day on, Kotecha says, he was obsessed with every dimension of writing and performing music. He taught himself to play piano while studying music theory. He sang in both the school choir and in a boy band. He devoured books about the history of pop music and explanatory guides about music labels and music publishers. As Kotecha dreamed of a life writing songs that soak the airwaves, his practical studies suffered. He might have gotten into more trouble for skipping classes, but his choir teacher recognized the young kid's talent as something potentially extraordinary. When Kotecha's mother would phone the school, this music instructor would often take the call and cover for him with an excuse for his absences. "My parents were freaking out," Kotecha told me about his early music habit, quickly offering by way of explanation, "They were very traditional Indian parents." He sent out hundreds of demo tapes and received more than 100 dismissive letters, which he deliberately saved like pelts of rejection. When he graduated and insisted that his future was still in an industry that had so consistently offered nothing but spurning, Kotecha's dad gave his son an ultimatum. He said, "I had 2 years to be a loser, and then I had to go to college," he recalled with a laugh. Kotecha hustled his way into music festivals. At South by Southwest, Austin's Music and Everything Else Festival, he would drive downtown to the Doubletree and other hotels, slink into the lobby, and pass out demo tapes to every A&R scout who walked through the doors. The Doubletree kicked him out several times. Kotecha learned to pack multiple disguises. When hotel management showed him the door, he would return several minutes later in a new shirt, only to be kicked out again, and return, again, in another new outfit with more demos. Finally, in 1999, Kotecha caught a break. A New York music executive with deep connections in Stockholm gave him instructions that would change his life. Go to Sweden. If pop music were a global technology, Sweden would be its Silicon Valley. Sweden and Swedish expats are the world's inexhaustible fount of catchy melodies. Led by Max Martin, the legendary super producer responsible for dozens of number one singles by the Backstreet Boys, Katy Perry, and Taylor Swift, the small Scandinavian country has been exporting contagious music to the world since ABBA debuted in the 1970s. Why Sweden? The answer involves a mix of policy, history, and the magnetizing effect of talent. First, the Swedish government actively promotes public music education at a time when many countries have no such policy. "I have public music education to thank for everything," Martin said in 2001. Second, Sweden has a musical culture that promotes major chord melodies over lyrics, which makes their songs highly exportable to audiences who don't speak Swedish. Third, since ABBA's heyday in the 1970s, Sweden has built a national industry dedicated to writing, producing, and selling pop music, which attracts some of the best pop talent in the world, like a gifted Indian-American teenager from Austin, Texas. Economists sometimes call this magnetizing effect agglomeration, and it's why similar companies have a tendency to congregate in the same cities. When geographers at Uppsala University studied Sweden's music industry, they said that it followed a model that economist Michael Porter calls industrial clustering. The same way that talented entrepreneurs go to San Francisco to be around people like them in the software industry, songwriters gravitate to Swedish power centers. "In Sweden, I met up with Red One, Lady Gaga's songwriter, and his whole crew," Kotecha recalled. "Through another connection there, I met Simon Cowell and became involved with The X Factor, which made me the lead coach and songwriter for One Direction. A few years later, I met Max Martin, and then everything really exploded." Kotecha is rapturous about Martin, who for several decades has been at the core of this spool of Swedish songwriters. In an interview with The Hollywood Reporter, he compared Martin to the Michael Jordan of pop music. "The comparison fascinated me. I can see clearly what makes Michael Jordan a great shooter and defender. I wondered if the originator of the analogy could apply a bit of rigor to the ineffable art of songwriting. So I asked Kotecha, if Michael Jordan is Michael Jordan because he can score efficiently, what makes Max Martin his industry's Michael Jordan?" Kotecha did not hesitate to answer. "That's easy. He has the best ear for catchy melodies, maybe the best in pop history," he said. "He can write great melodies, he understands what's wrong with other people's melodies, he's a genius song doctor, an amazing arranger, and an amazing finisher." "What did Max Martin teach you?" I asked. "That great pop music is very, very structured," Kotecha continued. The construction of a pop song is something almost mathematical. Max taught me that each part has to speak to the other parts. If the verse starts on the one, the first beat, the pre-chorus should start on the one. Melodies need to get to the hook quickly and then repeat. That's what makes it catchy. What is that thing? Catchiness. What is it about a line of melody that makes a hook irresistible? Even the best songwriters sometimes cannot explain the anatomy of a great hook. Like many artists quizzed on the specific mechanics of their process, they react the way an ordinary person would if asked to explain the finer details of breathing. The skill is so intrinsic that the mechanics become invisible. To understand the basic elements of catchiness, why we like what we like from song and speech, it's worth starting at the beginning. How does a sound become a song? One morning, in the spring of 2009, Walter Boyer, a fifth-grade music teacher at the Atwater School in Shorewood, Wisconsin, asked his 18 fifth-grade students to listen to a recording of a woman speaking. As they sat still, a lilting voice came over the air.
"The sounds as they appear to you are not only different from those that are really present, but they sometimes behave so strangely as to seem quite impossible."
This was a topsy-turvy sentence for a group of unsuspecting fifth graders. Some crinkled their faces as if the words were ancient German, but they kept listening. As the recording continued, several words played again.
"Sometimes behave so strangely."
And again.
"Sometimes behave so strangely."
Again.
"Sometimes behave so strangely." "Sometimes behave so strangely." "Sometimes behave so strangely."
As these four words looped over and over, something quite strange happened. Through repetition, the spoken words seemed to develop a rhythm and even a melody. Smiles broke across the children's faces. "Try it," Mr. Boyer suggested, and suddenly, as if reading sheet music, the students broke into song in perfect unison. "Sometimes behave so strangely," they sang together. Many giggled at the shock of ordinary words transforming as if by magic into music. Some of them even danced in their seats. Mr. Boyer stopped the recording. "Did you hear the melody?" he asked the class. "Yeah," they replied in the lazy drawl of kids forced to answer an obvious question. "Was she ever really singing, though?" "No," they said. "So why do you think it happened?" The class was silent. Several weeks later, Diana Deutsch, a psychologist at the University of California, San Diego, received a video of Mr. Boyer's fifth grade class. Deutsch was hosting a dinner party at her home in La Jolla. She nearly cried at the sight of 18 children singing with a voice, her voice, as it transformed from speech into music by mere repetition. Deutsch is a detective of musical illusions. Her most famous discovery is the phenomenon witnessed in Mr. Boyer's music class. It is the speech-to-song illusion. If you take a spoken phrase and repeat it at a common interval, the spoken words can evolve to sound like music. When Deutsch plays the "sometimes behave so strangely" phrase to her own research subjects, they invariably sing back a melody so precise that it has a key, time signature, syncopation, and rhythm. When somebody is talking, there is a central executive in the brain that makes decisions about whether a phrase is spoken or sung, Deutsch told me. Repetition is a clue. It tells the brain to listen for music. More than an elusive trick, repetition is the God particle of music. Humpback whales, white-handed gibbons, and more than 400 American species of birds are considered singers, and animal researchers reserve the term sing for only specific sounds that repeat at common intervals. The power of repetition in human music is fractal, appearing at every level. Repetition of rhythm is necessary to build a musical hook. The repetition of hooks is necessary for choruses. Choruses repeat several times in each song, and people often honor their favorite songs by putting them on repeat. As every parent can attest, children love hearing the same songs again and again. But grown-ups aren't so different. 90% of the time people listen to music, they are listening to a song they've already heard. Occasionally, people will hear music on loop even when they don't want to. For example, when a song gets stuck in our heads. This phenomenon is called an earworm, and it is an old and global scourge. The English term comes from the German Ohrwurm, literally earworm, while the French call it musique entêtante, or stubborn music. Thomas Edison invented the phonograph in 1877, 1 year after Mark Twain published a story in the Atlantic Monthly about young students haunted by an irresistible jingle. This is one cultural affliction that critics cannot blame on technology. The fault is in our brains. Therein resides the real mystery. Earworms are stranger than they appear. If you show a friend one quarter of a Claude Monet painting, she will not spend the next 30 minutes complaining that she cannot stop seeing the other three quarters. If she does, take her directly to a research hospital. Why do people get earworms but not, pardon the imagery, eye worms, or nose worms, or tongue worms for that matter? Earworms are like a keyhole into music's manipulation of times past and future. The earworm-infested brain is stuck in a loop between repetition, I want to remember how this goes, and anticipation, I want to know how this ends. This very entanglement, the pull of repetition versus the push of anticipation, defines the catchiest songs. I think back to my favorite hooks and how they often seem to break in half, a fall and a rise, a question and its answer. Swinging down at Bye Bye and swinging up at Miss American Pie. Low at With the Lights Out and high at It's Less Dangerous. Rising at She Loves You and falling at Yeah, Yeah, Yeah. A step down at Hey, I Just Met You. And a step up at And This Is Crazy. A great musical hook is a great question with an answer that asks to repeat the question. People like new and surprising melodies, said Elizabeth Margulis, a musicologist at the University of Arkansas Music Cognition Lab. But when we feel like we can accurately make tiny predictions about how a song is going to go, it feels really good. It takes no effort to recall a catchy tune. The melody is self-remembering. When a song gets stuck in your head, it can drive you crazy. But since the affliction is universal, timeless, and self-inflicted, it must say something about our internal circuitry. An earworm is a cognitive quarrel. The automatic mind craves repetition that the aware brain finds annoying. As we heard earlier, perhaps the unconscious self wants more repetition, wants more of the old, wants more of the familiar, than the conscious self thinks is good. This is not merely a theory about the annoying jingles that you can't get out of your head. The underrated allure of repetition is a fundamental basis of the entire pop music economy. The Billboard Hot 100, is the standard register of popularity in American music. It has counted down the top songs in the United States every week since 1958. But the Billboard list has been built on lies, half-lies, and made-up statistics.